thank you for being here with us this evening, this afternoon,
whatever time it is,
that's right.
May it please the court, I don't know if it's unusual for an appellee to show up by themselves, but we hope to get through these Barrett cases with our boots on, and one of the things that I want to do is to direct the court's attention to a case that I think is probably mandatory for its consideration, this case that was overlooked in the briefs. And that is a case called Johnson versus Commonwealth, 19 Virginia App 163, decided in 1994. And in that case, Mr. Johnson was a criminal defendant, and he was also a member of the United States Navy. And he showed up for his trial wearing his Navy uniform. And so it's a case about courtroom apparel like we have in this case. And that's why I think it's a authority that if I had found it before, I should have cited it in the brief and discussed it. And in that case, the circuit court ruled that the Navy officer, I think he was an officer too, couldn't wear his uniform for his trial. Sent him out, told him to wear something else.
But did not continue hearing evidence.
What this court wound up saying was, part of courtroom decorum is what people are wearing, and the court has authority to control the clothes that people are wearing and make sure that they're dressed appropriately for the circumstances. And on the merits, the court said this was error to send the Navy officer out of the courtroom because of his uniform, that he was entitled to wear that. That wasn't prejudicial to the maintaining good order in the courtroom and the things that a court can control with regard to what people wear. But the court went on, the Court of Appeals in that case went on to say that it was harmless error. So did it a harmless error analysis and said that even though this Navy officer should have been allowed to wear the clothes that he chose to wear because they didn't have a strong enough effect on, you know, order in the court, nevertheless, it was reviewed on a harmless error basis and it didn't affect the outcome of the case. Now, I don't remember all of the details, but I think that, in a nutshell, is where we are in this case.
Well, in this particular case, the case that's before us, and looking at it from a harmless error perspective, my understanding, and I'd like you to correct me if I'm wrong in this, is that during the 30 or 45 minutes of Mr. Barrett's absence while he went out to become appropriately dressed, that the court took up motions but did not receive any argument. Those motions were decided on the pleadings, and many of those had been argued and re-argued on multiple occasions before. And the only other thing that was done in Mr. Barrett's absence was the start of your testimony, if I recall correctly, on the fee issue. Was there anything else?
You're exactly right. And, you know, Mr. Barrett complained about Judge Alexander, but, you know, in the context of this, you know, we've got a judge from out of the area. We're in Bristol. Judge Alexander is there from Franklin County, so he traveled that morning from Rocky Mount to get to court and shows up, and Mr. Barrett, in his mind, is dressed inappropriately, and Judge Alexander, I guess, as a lot of circuit judges who had driven a couple of hours early in the morning might have done, said, "We're going. This is ridiculous. A lot of this is ridiculous, and we're going to go forward." But the idea that we had an evidentiary at all hearing at all was something that I objected to strenuously. There are so many cases, and we cited them in our brief, where attorney's fee litigation is decided on the papers. Unless you're going to show up with a live witness, a counter expert, somebody who's going to say you didn't really work these hours, or this was, you know, the litigation that there is usually saying you've got the big city lawyer here and this is a country fee case. and people argue about whether the rate is too high, or they say there's duplication on the fee, the number of hours, and you know, we've all seen big, complicated fee petitions that involve lots of issues that weren't present here.
But in this particular case, there was expert testimony, correct?
There was expert testimony, and Mr. Barrett was there for all of that. And the expert was a, you know, a local lawyer. And again, that's something else that Mr. Barrett asked for. Judge Alexander granted over my objection. Whether it added anything to the case or not, I don't know.
But based on the evidence that was presented, the trial court determined that the fair and reasonable hourly rate for the kinds of services that you had provided in the case was $210 an hour.
Yes.
Correct.
Yes.
Is that the same rate? You've made a request at the end of your brief in this case for additional fees to cover these proceedings. Is your request made at the same hourly rate?
Yes.
Have you determined what number of hours you have had to put into this that were all reasonably required for the proceeding?
No.
Okay.
I haven't. You know, the last time it was remanded to the circuit court for that to be done, and if that needs to be done for this case, I haven't done it. And if that affects my fee request, then I don't get any fees, and I can live with that. But if there's a remand, I would have a calculation including the time spent here.
Well,
today.
It seems to me under the rule there may be another alternative, and that is, are you willing to provide the court with an affidavit setting forth the hours that you have expended and vouching in that affidavit that all the hours that you put in were reasonable and necessary for this particular case, and have that affidavit witnessed and notarized and then forwarded, of course, a copy to Mr. Barrett and the original to the court?
Absolutely. I'm more than willing to do that.
And that would be based on the hourly rate that was testified to?
Yes, from 2016.
Yeah,
identify that
for the additional additional hours were
incurred in relation to this appeal.
Yes,
that brings you before us today.
Yes.
Let me ask you, shifting gears, is the youngest child Katie, and is she 17 now?
Katie will be 18 in about 143 days, but who's counting?
But who's counting?
And Katie is the youngest, is that right?
She is.
Oh, all right.
She's the only minor left at this point.
She is.
Underage, you might say, in this.
Yeah. The grown-ups are the minors in our family. There was some other stuff that required a little bit of follow-up. One of the arguments Mr. Barrett raises is what I call the Nussbaum argument, which is that you have to cite a statute to award attorney's fees, and the statute we wound up citing was 16.1 278.19, and he said that's cheating this court last time and didn't mention it, and so there was a case decided in the interim called Environmental Specialist Inc. versus Wells Fargo Bank, which is 291 Virginia 111, decided in 2016 by the Supreme Court, and in that case, I'll just quote it. It says, although nothing in the record on appeal reveals that counsel or the trial court relied upon Code Section 8.01 271.1 as a basis for its ruling, nonetheless, we will consider whether the sanctions or award of fees and costs are justified pursuant to the statute. And so that's an example where I think the Supreme Court has done what I'm asking this court to do, which is, even though the statute wasn't cited, you can look at it now and see and apply it as if it was.
On the bankruptcy, can I ask you on that?
Yes.
So is this a Chapter 7 bankruptcy that you said?
It is now.
It is now. And the court, it seems like since everything was filed with us, the bankruptcy court in Pennsylvania issued its decision. Was it in May? What is dischargeable and what is not? Is that correct or not? Am I misunderstanding?
It's not that straightforward.
Okay.
What happens in bankruptcy cases, and there is a case, I don't have the reference now, where this happened, and this may be what happened in our case. He filed a Chapter 13, converted to Chapter 7. They enter a generic discharge order that says Mr. Baer's debts are discharged to the extent they're dischargeable.
And that's the May order, I think I saw.
And I don't recall the date, but that is the order that lifted the stay and allowed us to go forward in cases wherever the stay applied. But that does not address the boundary between what is dischargeable and not dischargeable. Now, we, in the discharge statutes, there is a concept of a domestic support obligation, and then there's also a statute that says that in addition to what counts as domestic support obligations, any court that's entered directing you pay money to your spouse that was entered by a court is also non-dischargeable. So for Chapter 7, both those apply. So we imagine that someday this will be litigated, but it has not been as such to date. They've entered a discharge order, but the particulars may wind up being resolved someday in state court in Virginia.
And the attorney's fees issues, not the one now, since it's after the discharge date, but the ones before that, that's not addressed by the...
That's not addressed. Mm-hmm. We filed proof of claim, claimed they were priority claims, domestic support obligations, there have been no objection to the claims as such. But there's been no adversary proceedings or motions that would allow the specific issue, are these particular debts non-dischargeable? And so we have not only the attorney's fees that were awarded in this case, there's also costs from another case that was decided in 2016, and then there's other attorney's fees out there that may or may not come about that were from the child support cases that were decided in 2011. I think you were on the panel in that, and you were our dissenting vote saying that they should be affirmed on all issues, so I appreciate that, but that's never been awarded, and there we've got ongoing stuff related to that that's way off the record that we're talking about now. But one thing that Mr. Baer did add to the record that I wanted to mention was he attached the final order from case number CL-15-436. That case was appealed to Supreme Court, actually appealed twice. The order that you have before you decides what I call the Crowley argument and the Green argument, just the same as in that case as in this case. And the Supreme Court ruled in record number 16-1022 in March of 2017 that there was no error in the ruling by Judge Alexander in 15 CL-436, which was that the Green argument, which is the idea that the child support, the next round of custody cases got started before the last round ended, affected the subject matter jurisdiction to do anything about custody and visitation. That argument's been rejected in that case. And then the other is the Crowley argument. Is he's got these arguments where he says any legal error committed in the trial court is therefore constitutional error, is therefore jurisdictional error, and so it can be raised in any collateral attack by motion, which is the thing that he cites Crowley for. So I call that the Crowley argument, and that was also rejected. That was count one in case number CL-1436, where he was challenging the 2012 order, the 2010 order, and all of these things. So these issues come up in other cases, and they're getting to the end, and they have done already in the 15-436. The last thing that I wanted to mention is his assignment of error number 10 is that you can't get fees without fees incurred, and we don't deny at all that Ms. Miner didn't. This was a totally pro bono project.
Your time has value, though, sir, and that was already established by expert testimony, correct?
Yes. And this is an issue that's not to suggest that I have a conflict of interest here, but I'm on the Southwest Virginia Legal Aid Board and have been for many years. And as a a matter of public policy, I think it's really important that poor people especially be able to get the benefit of these statutes. And so I hope that by litigating this, I'm not messing up the law for people who are in a lot worse shape than we are with respect to when and how they can get fees in this kind of circumstance. If there's no other questions, I thank you all.
We will stay. We thank
one
you.
One quick thing.
Oh, okay.
Just, given that you're a practicing attorney, as a number of us on this side of the bench have all been, I assume you probably keep billable hours by the day.
Yes.
So you might, in the affidavit, want to, rather than just giving a total number, you might want to sort of break it down as you spent time over day, if that's possible.
I have time records for basically all of this stuff because it's going to come up. I have to have it for good and for ill.
What you said, yes, you could do when you suggested an affidavit of time spent. And so, total based on your hour that the court below set.
There will be some rounding, and it will be rounded down. I can assure you of that. But there'll be a detailed list of days and hours. It may not be the best in terms of this part of the research was done on this particular afternoon because I don't always keep it in that detailed, but short of the block time issue, it would be pretty specific to days and amounts.
Well, and we are mindful that there may be attorney-client confidences reflected in those timesheets. We're not looking for you to violate any of that.
Right.
We'll step down and greet